Speaking of Reliability, a podcast with good friends talking with you about reliability engineering topics. Let's discuss how to create and improve your reliability program and your career. Welcome to Speaking of Reliability. This is Fred Schenkelberg, and today we're doing a follow-up from our previous episode where John Paskowicz joined us. And I believe you're on the line, John.
Yes, I am. Thanks, Fred.
All right. Great. And Kirk, if you can hear me, we were having a little bit of audio problems. And Kirk, you're still on the line?
Yeah, Fred. Good to hear your voice again.
All right. Well, I wanted to bring up a follow-on question. John, in the previous episode, you were talking about halt on mechanical systems. And in the discussion on motors, you started talking about what to me sounded like an accelerated degradation test, is where you're monitoring the performance of the motors as the bearings would increase the resistance. You could monitor that and define a failure point, which is, to me, is a classic degradation test, which to me is very different than a halt test. So could you expand a little bit about, you know, do you design a degradation test right from the start, or start as a halt test and then you switch over, or are they very, very similar in some mechanical systems?
I think it's something you need to design from the start. As I mentioned in the previous session, when we go into planning the test on this type of equipment, mechanical equipment, the thing I suggested was using an upfront risk analysis at a high level one like DRBFM, design review based on failure modes, or top-down FMEA, even at the concept level. And we're looking at what are potential failure mechanisms on this product. And once we have those, then we can plan the testing. And in a lot of mechanical systems, the failure mode is not going to be a catastrophic failure mechanism. It's going to be a wear out. It's going to take repetitive loading and cumulative damage to produce that failure. And does that really constitute a halt test? In some ways, it does, because the first thing you have to do is find the limits of that particular product so you could plan, where am I going to test at? Then you could plan your degradation testing, which is more like you suggested, a traditional accelerated degradation test.
Yeah. So, John, when you're saying find the limits, you're talking about the load limit, for example. If I have a beam and I'm worried about cyclic failures, but if I want to accelerate that, I can't just load it up with multi-tons in it because it'll just snap off. Is that the limit you're looking for, is where the structural failure occurs versus the more cyclic failure damage occurs?
Yeah. To just like any other accelerated life test, you need to know how much can I accelerate it, and that's from the use level planned load or the design load up to what is the load that would quickly produce a failure. So that gives you a margin to do the acceleration within. So you still need to know that limit to plan your accelerated degradation test. Then you can plan your loading according to what your limit is. You start from the upper limit and work down a certain amount where, okay, I can go to this level. Now, which levels am I actually going to test at within that range? So you still need to find those limits like we suggest we do in HALT, but then for the actual testing, it's more of a cumulative damage, and how can I accelerate that mechanism?
Right. Now, Kirk, we do, in electronics, you do something similar, don't you, with like on voltage margining. If we know that, say, there's an accumulated damage due to voltage, is like a startup current is probably a better example. You may find where the maximum current is, where it just blows out components. And is that consistent with the design? But then you back up and you say, well, what's the accumulated damage because of the way we are operating this equipment? And then switch over to a more traditional accelerated life test.
In electronics, I mean, with pure solid state electronic circuits, it really the life potential or the life entitlement of electronic components is extremely long relative to most mechanical components. So that's a very, very difficult, that really requires more prognostics and health management type monitoring of degradation, such as in an IGBT integrated or insulated gate bipolar transistor, you might look at the some increase in degradation of switching or speed or something like that. But those are really hard to achieve. So in you can do that in certain components or with certain specific components. But as far as the system goes, it becomes really very complex. That's why I'm glad John added to our book some of the ALT tests that can be run and some examples of ALT tests, not HALT, but actual three-tiered, three-level stress or whatever to make estimates of the degradation life of a product. And I think that's an important aspect. It's not as common with or easily measured with electronic components, although a PHM, prognostics and health management, is trying to do more of that analysis, and that's an opening field, or definitely a field that has increased in interest in measuring remaining useful life in electronics, which is a much more challenging than in mechanical systems.
So, John, I mean, it overlaps, though, between the mechanical degradation of materials in like thermal cycling or current loading affects materials. And in a larger mechanical system, we're still changing the metallurgy or the metal's fundamental characteristics. The polymers get creep and all these other things that change their ability to withstand loads. So it really is a blend between what's my system's capabilities, the material capabilities, but then also, how does it age over time?
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Yeah, that's a very important consideration. And kind of spinning off of that and Kirk's comments on prognostics and health management is obviously becoming a key methodology in a lot of systems now, both mechanical and electronic, where the key parameters are monitored, and it can help with scheduling preventive maintenance or replacement of components and things like that. So, and those measure parameters that degrade over repeated loading. So to help with that prognostics and health management, we would need to have some understanding of how these particular components are degrading. And so doing this kind of limit and degradation testing would help us with those prognostic systems.
John, you were one time telling me about, I think, a heater coil or some heater testing. It was a mechanical system that you did some HALT tests. Was that correct?
Sure, that's correct. Electric heaters are an interesting example for HALT testing. And the typical failure mechanisms are either thermal fatigue from turning on and off, expanding and contracting of the heating element, oxidation of the heating element at sustained high temperature, or dielectric failure where the power arcs through to the surface. So those are the three main mechanisms. And what we do in heater tests is we do a step stress. And so applying external temperature or vibration is not going to cause a heater failure. You have to apply power to it. So we step up the voltage applied, and it goes up to a limit, and then the heater fails. And typically in the more catastrophic thing where the element just fails open is the desired one. And sometimes it will arc through to the sheath or the surface, and then it's failed. So we know that's an upper limit. For the actual testing of the heater, then we do a cycling test where we'll apply accelerated levels, you know, at the typical quantitative accelerated test method where you have, say, three different stress levels we apply it at and we cycle those to actual failure. But to do that, again, we need that upper limit. So we do a step stress limit test and then apply the accelerated power and voltage to it and monitor the current to the temperatures at various points on the surface.
As we talk about like HASS, which is a process of screening using the boundaries that you find in HALT, it's a similar methodology. First find the limits, your safe space, or your safe stresses or stresses that you know won't cause catastrophic failure. And within that window, then you apply fatiguing cycling or cycle fatigue stresses to degrade or cause it to fail over time and essentially degrade the material strength. When we talk about, you talked about aircraft and we've talked about wings a little bit. One of the things is you do have a cyclic fatigue in aircraft. And you talked about, I assume that, you know, in a pressurized fuselage, you cycle it by pressurizing it to some level of what you would do in a flight or maybe even higher. Is that true? Do you know if that's, do they overpressurize the cabin during the development and testing?
Yes, they do. Now, we applied accelerated test levels and then applied those fail-safe cuts I was mentioning in the previous ones where certain points in the structure are deliberately severed and then continue pressurizing it to make sure we don't have catastrophic rupture of the structure. It can withstand the pressure loads even with some damage in place.
A lot of the 737s are quite old, and I would assume have some fatigue cracks in the metal somewhere. I mean, eventually some fatigue will happen and you have some fatigue cracks developing. I would assume as soon as the first fatigue crack or there is some measure of what's an acceptable crack length or how far this, you know, crack can be before the product or the 737 and aircraft is taken out of service. Do you know how that's done or how they determine that?
Yeah, you're basically correct that they inspect for crack length. And it also depends on the number of flight hours and takeoffs and landings the aircraft has had. The FAA maintenance requirements include inspections of the structure periodically and based on the utilization. And when they're looking for fatigue damage, that can result in grounding of the aircraft if they exceed a particular crack length and so on. And there have been aircraft more so on the military side where the life has been extended by actually doing structural replacement, wing box replacement, and so on to extend the life of that airframe. Yeah. So when they know monitoring where the fatigue damage is and gets to a point where, no, this is not safe for flight, then we're going to take it in and do a program to upgrade that structure. Yeah, there is a regular inspection and maintenance procedure to monitor.
Is there a point that you wouldn't get on a plane? I know when I got on, sometimes when I go on an aircraft, I can see in the doorway the actual date of manufacture and other information. I'm assuming that even the 737s are quite an old aircraft, or can be. They've been flying for decades. Would you ever be worried about boarding a plane due to its age?
Yeah. But yeah, the inspection levels, I think, for here, as far as the FAA requiring that, the airlines comply pretty well with doing that. I would be concerned about some foreign airlines, and I know the Russians have had a lot of accidents involving aircraft, and there have been questions raised about their maintenance procedures and inspection of these aircraft. And some of the other countries where you don't really know what they're doing to maintain those aircraft. Yeah, that would be a real concern. Some of the older aircraft there, and they, you know, smaller countries will buy used aircraft that have been spun off by major airlines, and I don't think I would ever fly on one of those. But yeah, I think the FAA does a pretty good job in its maintenance requirements. And
yeah, I feel pretty safe here in the U.S. And and I've worked with some of the Boeing people and talked with them about the methodology. And they used to be calling HALT reliability enhancement testing, RET. I don't know if that's still being used, but I assume that some of that's been still in Boeing and other aircraft companies, but have no idea because, again, most companies don't talk about their methodologies too much from a competitive standpoint. Even Airbus and Boeing having a competition. But
jump in there is while we've got John on the line, we should ask him what kind of car he drives.
I drive a BMW. John
as a reliability engineer, do you ever get asked what car? BMW.
Yeah, I drive a BMW. So.
Has it been reliable for you?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I have a 2007. It's 9 years old, and it's been the most reliable car I've ever owned. I didn't order it with a lot of the options that sometimes cause problems. Like I specifically did not order it with iDrive because that had been problematic back in those days. But I think they've improved it now. But it's been a great. Mm-hmm. I have driven European
cars. Is that like the autopilot on Tesla?
No. It's the, kind of the central, infotainment kind of system for where you have your navigation and audio systems and all that involved. Mine was built before the current state of technology with all the active driving aids like the active cruise control and the radar systems they have on it now to keep your spacing and lane maintenance and all that. No, I don't have that equipment on. I have owned mainly European and Japanese cars since the 70s. So.
Yes, me too.
Kirk, so you're not driving a Detroit built car either?
No, I drive a Honda. We've had Toyotas and right now Honda and a Lexus. So, I'm sorry. I had an experience back in the 1990s, where I worked with the UAW in Kokomo, Indiana, at Delco Electronics Manufacturing Plant. And there's a lot of special challenges in that environment. So I just have seen, and I also go by Consumer Reports, which is a pretty unbiased, I believe, publication and organization. And before I buy a car, I do look at the Consumer Reports evaluation of the history of the car, because I think that does tell you a lot about their manufacturing capabilities and their design capabilities.
John, I think one of the things that attests to the importance of maintenance, and we were talking about the aircraft, is those inspections, but also knowing what to inspect for. And that sometimes gets learned the hard way with vehicles and with other structural systems is, we keep pushing the levels of technology. We're now using composites on aircraft and learning as we go in some cases of, how do they respond over time? How do they respond to vibration or temperature and so on? So it is a blend of HALT style testing to find limits, And then a healthy blend of accelerated testing to characterize the wear out mechanisms and characterize the degradation of performance. And so when we, I mean, you guys put the, from what I understand and from what I've read, is you've added that mix of, well, HALT has a role and you need to do this other characterization type work as appropriate to really understand your systems. But then it follows up with the appropriate maintenance and appropriate maintenance practices and inspections and so on. So it's no one tool that works for everything. And it has to be adapted to the systems and the materials and the technology that you're dealing with. Is that a fair summary there?
I think you gave a really good point. And one of the really critical things that John and I wanted to mention, you know, say with the book is HALT and HAS and accelerated testing is a highly adaptive process. You have to understand the physics of what you're dealing with. You have to understand the materials of what you're dealing with. And it's not just blindly going and taking things to limits. But first, as John talked about, doing a design-based failure mode analysis and looking at the product, understanding the field environments a lot of times, but also understanding the materials and the special application that the product will be in. But as we say in the book, it's a very highly adaptive process, and that's a very key point to HALT and both HALT and HAS is everyone is unique in its application.
That's, I agree, Kirk. And one of the things I did in the couple of the chapters I worked on in the book was to integrate the selection of these tests with an overall product development process and show where it fits in and where you would choose the different tools and where you would do accelerated life testing and where you would do a screening like HAS. And so that way the reader can see where to adapt it in their particular product development process.
Right. We want to make sure the potential reader knows that there is much material about mechanics. Even though we start with robust design of electronics, the reason we added systems to the title was the fact that John has added a lot of good information about more mechanical systems, since he is a mechanical engineer and a certified reliability engineer, and has added a lot of material in the book that covers that ground. So the book does cover a lot of both some of the traditional approaches, but mixed in with the basic fundamentals of HALT and how to establish the boundaries of those ALT tests.
All right. Well, it sounds like, I mean, that's a great summary. Thanks, Kirk and John. The idea here is that, and I think, John, we're going to have to invite you back again, get you back on the show again here a couple more times. It's a pretty rich area, and I'm just thinking of all the different examples, and I won't mention them here because we're running out of time on this episode. But if you're listening to this in the audience and you've got a question or an idea that you'd like us to explore with John or have him talk about some more or any of the co-hosts of the show, let us know. Head over to reliability.fm and you can find Speaking of Reliability and plenty of opportunities to add comments, or there's a suggestion box, and or just track down our email and send us a note. We'd be glad to hear from you. We do get comments on occasion. We're getting about one a week, one or two a week, but it really makes my day when I hear from a listener that, one, you like the show, appreciate that, but also if you bring in an idea, a suggestion, because that helps us understand what makes this show most valuable for you. So we'd like to hear from you and any of your ideas and suggestions. So with that, I'm going to say thanks, Kirk and John, and we'll wrap it up for today.
Thanks, Fred.
Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation. If you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show, please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes. or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.